Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 28, 2018. South Sudan Government Information Minister accuses Troika and the U.S. of trying to set agenda and outcome at the High-Level Revitalization Forum.
The Troika and the EU are not just supporting opposition because they like them, but they want them to dance to their tune. And if you don't dance to their tune, then you are a bad element. And this is why they declared President Salva not to be an unfit partner, because he did not implement what they want.
And a U.S. diplomat calls on Juba to respect the cessation of hostility agreement.
Yesterday, the U.S. Embassy issued a statement criticizing the government for its actions over the weekend by National Security Service agents to block a civil society leader from traveling to a transitional justice forum. We find these actions unacceptable.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's information minister is lashing out at the U.S., the United Kingdom and Norway, as well as other European countries, accusing them of having vested interest in South Sudan's peace process. Michael Makuei accuses the Troika and EU of using the regional bloc IGAD, which has been mediating the peace talks, to try to remove President Salva Kiir from office. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Michael Makuei told reporters gathered at a news conference in Juba today that IGAD is not in control of the High-Level Revitalization Forum in Addis Ababa. He accused the Troika and the EU of using the IGAD to try to achieve what he calls regime change in South Sudan. Makuei says South Sudan's government thinks IGAD is not in the driver's seat at the forum and accused the regional bloc of implementing Troika's and EU's agenda.
Troika and EU are the ones funding the peace process, and as such, they are the ones on the driving seat, because he who pays the piper calls the tune. They are the ones calling the tune, and even this document, which widened the gap, this zero draft which was given to us, was imposed on the mediation. We are fully informed about that, because the Troika have their own agenda. The Troika, of course, and the European Union, they have their own agenda.
Makuei, who has been sanctioned by the United States and EU, calls any proposal at the High-Level Revitalization Forum, which considers the removal of President Salva Kiir, a non-starter. He also claims South Sudanese leaders understand the country's problems better than outsiders and should be left to resolve them.
Even though there are people who claim over there that they are more concerned about the lives and the livelihoods of the people of South Sudan, this is not correct. There is no way someone would come to me from Troika and tell me that I understand your problem better than me, but than you. I'm ready to solve your problem better than you. So we need to believe in ourselves and trust in ourselves, other than trusting others and believing that these are the people who will bring us salvation. The Troika and the EU are not just supporting opposition because they like them, but they want them to dance to their tune. And if you don't dance to their tune, then you are a bad element. And this is why they declared President Salva not to be an unfit partner. Because of what? Because he did not implement what they want. He did not accept what they want.
Makuei's latest attack on Troika and EU is a violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in December. Article 4, subsection 3 of the cessation of hostilities agreement states that, quote, the parties shall not carry out unwarranted verbal attacks or any physical attacks against the citizen, JEMEC, IGAD, AU, UN, or any other entity associated with the implementation of this agreement, unquote. Makuei also says the Kiir administration rejects an IGAD proposal of having four vice presidents in a transitional government and a proposal to dissolve certain government institutions and establish new ones.
South Sudan is not a test case whereby you bring any new principle, you come and test it here. South Sudan is not a company, so that the power sharing is 51-49%. South Sudan is a sovereign state, and it has the right to decide on its own issues. the people of South Sudan are the ones who decide for themselves. Nobody from outside will ever come and impose on us whatever he thinks or whatever he has in mind. My appeal to those who are behind all this, please leave the people of South Sudan alone.
The information minister also lashed out at South Sudanese citizens who criticized the government for not reaching a final deal during the recent second phase of the high-level revitalization forum.
We did not go there for an event, but we went in for a process. And if it is a process, then this is how it is done. You go and discuss whatever you agree today, you initial it so that you don't renege from it tomorrow. I'm surprised that some of our citizens just took it for granted that we are going as if it is hanging on somewhere and we'll go and pick it and bring it back. No, we were going in to negotiate. And if we were going to negotiate, then we cannot just say that the government has failed to bring peace.
He also says targeted sanctions and an arms embargo will not shake the government or compel it to sign an imposed peace agreement. Makoi says sometimes in negotiations, you come back with nothing. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The United States Embassy in Juba issued a statement yesterday condemning a move by South Sudan security agents who were reported to have blocked a civil society leader from traveling outside the country. The civil society activist was traveling over the weekend to attend a transitional justice forum when he was asked by members of the National Security not to leave the country. Mark Weinberg is the public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Juba. He says restricting the movement of civil society members violates the cessation of hostility agreement signed last year by the various warring parties in South Sudan. Weinberg condemned the incident in Juba.
Yesterday, the U.S. Embassy issued a statement criticizing the government for its actions over the weekend by National Security Service agents to block a civil society leader from traveling to a transitional justice forum. We find these actions unacceptable.
Weinberg says the activist is the head of a recognized civil society group and took part in the recent high-level revitalization forum.
This action, directed against an officially recognized stakeholder in the high-level revitalization forum peace talks, calls into question the government of South Sudan's commitment to Article 5 of the 2015 Agreement on the Resolution of the Conflict in the Republic of South Sudan and the December 21, 2017 Cessation of Hostilities Agreement.
The U.S. diplomat says both the 2015 peace agreement and the cessation of hostilities agreement signed last December include language guaranteeing the rights and ensuring the protection of civilians and civil society.
The cessation of hostilities agreement specifically calls on the parties to encourage civil society to support and promote the agreement. We believe that civil society has an important role to play in resolving the conflict in South Sudan, which is now entering its fifth year.
Ed Moniakani is the executive director of the group Community Empowerment for Progress Organization. He was at a press conference today, and here is what he had to say.
I saw a statement, an activist being denied access to travel out of the country. In the statement, there's no specific naming of Edmond Yakane denying access to go to South Africa. This information started as a social media and now comes officially as a statement that I've seen outside. And what I'd like to say is that I don't want to preempt something. I'm doing my investigation. I'm putting out my statement on that. Yeah, because I don't preempt something that I didn't generate facts. You know, as a media, you need to have facts or you don't misinform the public. So I will call for a press conference like this one. I will make it.
Weinberg says the South Sudan government must support civil society groups rather than restricting their movement.
The government's efforts to silence civil society are pointless and embarrassing. We strongly urge the government of South Sudan to work with the country's civil society, not against it.
Last week, national security agents broke up a civil society meeting that was being held in Juba to discuss phase two of the high-level revitalization forum. The United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway have all condemned the action. Nabil Biagio prepared this report from Juba. Yei County residents say they want the newly appointed governor of Yei River State, Emmanuel Adil Anthony, to work to restore peace and stability and unite communities throughout the state. Last week, President Salva Kiir fired Governor David Lokonga Moses without an explanation. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei, where thousands of residents welcome Anthony back to Yei.
Thousands of residents of Ye Town stood alongside the road leading to the airstrip in Ye to welcome Governor Adel Anthony as he arrived in Ye after taking the oath of office in Juba last week. Ye Town resident Alan Tabant says people in Ye River State need peace.
We expect if this governor will come with very good policies so that we embrace peace, people are all happy. We need positive change as far as peace is concerned. If there is peace, definitely there will be what? Development.
Another resident, Agnes Nyoka, says she expects the new governor to work to protect the life and property of civilians.
We need to go back to our houses. We need to ensure that our children go to school. We need to see that pregnant mothers get the real services. We don't again want to see mothers dying in the bush. We wanted to see that people go to the market without any intimidation. We wanted to see that people have freedom of speech. Let us have right of speaking out our issues so that the people know what we suffer from.
Nyoka also appealed to Governor Adil to create a conducive environment for the safe return of other Ye residents who sought refuge in neighboring Uganda and DRC. Charles Agele says he hopes the new governor listens to the demands of the people of Ye River State.
He need to work according to the will of the people. You know, for you to do a good thing to your people, you must accept to be crucified. Imagine how Jesus died for the people. And this is the kind of a leader possibly we need. As he is coming, I think locally, we need to do something together to make sure that our state is safe.
Resident Francis Boboya says he too expects Adil to restore peace in the state.
Because youth particularly, I'm expecting that the governor have to work hand in hand with the ministers at least to speak to our brothers and who have taken up arms so that at least this issue of insecurity will come to an end. And secondly, we also want at least, the governor have to create for us other activities. We need to be kept busy.
Governor Adil says restoring peace and tranquility in the state is his first priority.
I have taken this assignment today. I just need your support. I would call for all the armed forces. Let's join hands to work together to protect the people of this state, to protect the people of South Sudan, to maintain peace and tranquility that the people are yearning for. His Excellency the President gave me one word. Governor, go and work with the people of Ye. Work with everybody in Ye. And I'm going to work with everybody. This is my declaration in this office. I will work with everybody so that we bring back normalcy to Ye, restore confidence back to our citizens so that they do about their lives. Time has come for us to be in real peace.
On January 3rd, several people were reported killed after fighting between government and rebel forces in Ye River State broke out. And earlier this month, local leaders and witnesses in Ye River State's Mukaya County said hundreds of civilians were forced to flee their homes after fighting broke out between SPLA-IO forces loyal to rebel leader Riek Machar and a group loyal to the governor of former Western Equatorial State, Joseph Bangasi Bakashoro. Witnesses and local officials said houses were burned and civilian property was looted. The continuous fighting between rebels and government troops is a clear violation of the December cessation of hostilities agreement signed by the various South Sudan's warring parties. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Ye.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at humanitarian challenges in war zones. That story is coming up after this break.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you feel loved and appreciated?
Even when most time I do something good and people praise me, somewhere like that thing you did, and that most time it makes me feel good.
What makes me feel loved, it's internal. I hardly have somebody who, you know, makes me feel loved. Although I would say my parents inspire me and push me on, but they have a strange way of doing it. Most times it's through criticism. When you are criticized, it spurs me up.
When actually people have concern about me, because there are different languages of love, okay? Some people do appreciate the word aspect of love. Some people, spoken words per se. Some people it is gift, so. But for me, what makes me feel loved, like I said earlier, is when people care for me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Yesterday, we brought to you a story about Humanitarian Grant Challenge, an initiative that look for new ways to change the way humanitarians deliver aid and help people around the world. Today, we are speaking to James Touch Madier, a South Sudanese-Canadian and a member of the Grant Challenge Steering Committee. Touch is encouraging South Sudanese to submit their ideas to the initiative.
There are a few opportunities that are available for sure. If they are not in South Sudan, they are in Kenya or outside of Kenya or elsewhere, where some organizations like the Solution Project are interested in finding ideas that they can fund from young people that are innovative and want to take center stage within their own communities to address problems.
What's the name of that organization that you just mentioned?
It's called the Resolution Project, and now with the Humanitarian Grant Challenge as well, the Humanitarian Grant Challenge is designed specifically for ideas that are coming from people that are affected by humanitarian crisis.
So you are on the other side of funding proposals. You're on the committee that looks at, you know, proposals that come in from young people all over the world, and you are one of the people who decides which project gets funded and which project does not get funded. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you're uniquely positioned, I think, to answer this next question, and that's, what is your advice to a young person who has an idea and is looking to get it funded? What would you tell them to include in their application or not include in their application? And what are some of the mistakes that you have seen in the application process that maybe a young person who is listening to this can avoid?
One thing which I think comes, which I have seen come from especially young people that are from places that have very limited exposure and limited opportunities, whenever they design their solutions and their ideas and they want to pass them on, they write as if they are begging for money. And I think that's a mistake because, you know, like when you apply for funding of your idea, you're not really begging for money. You know, you are requesting for funding of an idea that is innovative, that is going to impact people. So the money you are requesting for is not your money. It's money that is going towards an idea that could potentially change lives. That's one. Number two, it's also very important how you communicate the idea that you have. It could be the best idea ever, but you don't know how to structure it and communicate it precisely because there is a limit. We are receiving thousands of, for instance, Humanitarian Grant Challenge is anticipating to receive thousands of submissions from around the world. So it's very important to approach your submission knowing that, you know, you have to stand out. Yes, it could be a good idea, but you also have to stand out about how you communicate it. So that's number two. Number three is for an idea to be funded, this is not limited to Humanitarian Grant Challenge. It's very important to demonstrate that you have understood and you have refined your idea to an extent that if you get the funding, all you will need to do is to hit the ground running. So sometimes some young people misunderstand the call for ideas as brainstorming, so they want to just brainstorm and submit an idea that they've brainstormed just that night. I don't think whether it works like that. Your idea has to go through, for instance, if there are people within the professional field that within that area that you want to address your idea towards, it's I encourage really for anyone to reach out and refine the idea before they submit it. There are 8 weeks before the application is closed, you know. So those 8 weeks are enough for anyone to even walk through some sort of steps to make sure the idea is better. And then who is the team that you've put together around your idea? Do they know what they're doing? Do you yourself know what you're doing?
That was James Touch Madier, a member of the steering committee of the Humanitarian Grant Challenge, speaking to Ayen Deng Bior from New York. To learn more about the Humanitarian Grant Challenge, you can log on to humanitariangrantchallenge.org. The United Nations has set up a 24-hour helpline to fight sexual harassment among its staff in workplaces as part of its zero-tolerance policy regarding sexual exploitation and abuse. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the UN European headquarters in Geneva.
The so-called Speak Up Hotline is part of the UN Secretary General's wider initiative to fight sexual harassment and to support victims and witnesses. UN spokeswoman in Geneva, Alessandra Volucci, explains UN staff can call the helpline 24 hours a day to speak confidentially to a trained, impartial person about problems of sexual abuse and to provide information. She says the United Nations also is creating a specialized team to investigate cases of sexual harassment.
Particular attention in this will be given to increasing the number of female investigators. So basically we are strengthening our tools to answer to this problem and to put the victims at the core of our action.
While the United Nations can deal with internal problems of sexual harassment, Volucci says the organization has no control over the behavior of UN peacekeepers. She says it is ultimately the responsibility of the member state of the soldiers accused of sexual misconduct to investigate and prosecute these crimes. Officials from UN agencies condemned the recent reports that local workers and private charities were trading food and other assistance for sexual favors among Syrian women. UN refugee spokesman Andre Majecic calls the practice despicable and dehumanizing.
But the mere suggestion that the UN can somehow control the situation in a war zone and the implied conclusion that we can somehow turn this on and off is rather simplistic. It's disconnected from the reality of what an aid operation looks like in an open and fierce conflict.
The UNHCR and other UN aid agencies say their partners must adhere to a strict code of conduct which covers sexual exploitation and abuse. They say any UN personnel found to be in breach of the code would be subject to disciplinary measures, including dismissal from service. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's parliament has taken a first step toward enacting a policy that would allow the government to seize privately owned land without compensation. The plan, based on a policy by the ruling ANC party, aims to correct inequalities that have hurt the nation's mostly black population. The policy has its supporters, but as VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, it is unlikely that land will be confiscated anytime soon.
Lawmakers voted Tuesday to examine how the Constitution can be amended to allow land seizures, a move that resonates deeply in a nation where the white minority still controls much of the productive farmland. But the strongest proponent of the motion sought to reassure the nation that nothing too drastic would come of it. Here's far-left politician Julius Malema, right after the vote.
No one is going to lose his or her house. No one is going to lose his or her flat. No one is going to lose his or her factory or industry. All what we are saying is that they will not have the ownership. They will have lease depending on what is the arrangement, particularly as it relates to the outcome of the constitutional review process.
That is a direct rebuke to fears that this will put South Africa on the same path as Zimbabwe, where forceful seizures of white-owned farms in the early 2000s were blamed for that nation's economic freefall and political instability. The ruling African National Congress also supported Tuesday's motion, but with the provision that expropriation cannot hurt farm production, economic stability, or political stability, a fairly large and vague loophole, analysts say. And so the loudest group in support of land seizures, the Black First, Land First movement, has denounced the motion as nothing but an electioneering gimmick by the ANC. South Africa holds general elections sometime next year. The opposition Democratic Alliance voted against the measure and blames the slow pace of land redistribution on the ANC, which has ruled since the end of apartheid in 1994. The DA Shadow Deputy Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform, Ken Robertson, began his speech by saying in isiZulu, "People are suffering.
People were dispossessed of their land and their dignity by the discriminatory laws of the past. A painful past that can never be forgotten. The ANC's call for expropriation is just a lazy attempt to divert attention away from the real reasons that lie at the heart of the slow pace of meaningful land reform and restitution."
While this debate has no shortage of fiery rhetoric, what it lacks, says analyst Ibrahim Fakir, are concrete details.
At present, all bets are off. No one knows how and what this could mean. Theoretically, it could even mean that it does actually end up denying a regime of protection of private property, because we need to begin to get better at separating the instrumental from the moral and the moral from the policy. And that work hasn't been done.
No reliable figures on land ownership in South Africa exist, although a recent government study found that only a third of the nation's land is privately owned. Any changes to the Constitution require a 75% vote, meaning 300 of 400 members of Parliament would have to approve the change. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now go to Moyo District with the song Morina Opidri by Lanson Lee. We have been listening to Lanson Lee with the song Morini Opidri. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'll be my